Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Take a listen to this reaction to a terror event that happened. Quote, information was not shared. Analysis was not pooled. Often the handoffs of information were lost across the divide separating the foreign and domestic agencies of the government. Sounds like a response to the Christmas Day attempted bombing over Detroit, right? Well, think again. Those words were written years ago by the 9/11 Commission. So how do we end up right back in the same boat? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 31st. I'm Celeste Headlee here with Luke Burbank, who is filling in for John Hockenberry at least for a couple more days.
That's right. And then Monday, your long national nightmare is over.
Happy New Year's Eve anyway. But let's get right to the headlines. Here's the latest on the security breakdown that led to the attempted terrorist attack on Christmas Day. The Transportation Security Administration has ordered 150 more full-body scanners to be installed in airports throughout the country early in the new year. There's currently only 40 in place. We're also learning about the contents of the text messages that were sent from the suspect, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, to his father. Our partner, The New York Times, says the suspect wrote that he'd found the real Islam and his family should forget about him because he's never coming back. President Obama is expected to receive a report about that security breakdown sometime today.
This morning, the United Nations says it is temporarily moving some international staff out of Pakistan for security reasons in Afghanistan. A suicide bomber wearing a military uniform infiltrated an American base and blew himself up inside the gym, killing at least eight Americans believed to be working for the CIA. It's one of the deadliest attacks on U.S. intelligence personnel in the agency's history. We're joined now by Anand Gopal, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He joins us from Kabul, Afghanistan. Anand, what is the latest on this attack?
Well, this morning, the Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack, and they said that they used an Afghan army officer to carry it out, which, if true, would worry a lot of U.S. officials because it indicates that the insurgents are able to infiltrate the Afghan security forces.
We're still kind of looking for confirmation that the people who died were CIA. Are you getting that?
That's what it looks like, but the CIA itself hasn't said anything officially on the record. But it seems that at least some of the people that were killed were CIA.
Anand Gopal with The Wall Street Journal, thank you for joining us. We're going to talk more with you about this story later in the hour.
The U.S. Embassy in Bali is warning of a possible terrorist attack tonight. The warning comes 6 months after suicide blasts killed seven people at luxury hotels in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta. Here at home, chest pains have landed Rush Limbaugh in a Hawaiian hospital. The conservative host's radio show says he's resting comfortably and appreciates fans' well wishes.
And on this last day of 2009, we wanted to remind you of some of the lighter stories that made it into the news this year. Workplace productivity was in the news in Norway, where they introduced laws allowing cows to relax for up to half of the day on soft rubber mattresses. Officials, do not laugh, Celeste, officials say the cows are producing more milk than ever.
I would never laugh at the efficacy of soft rubber mattresses.
I'm putting it out there for the management here at The Takeaway, something to think about. Checking the markets, Asian stocks are up, racking up nearly 70% gains for the year. European indices are mixed as well. Futures are mixed. The Dow gets underway at 10,548. The S&P opens at 1,126. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,291.
You may have heard it is the last day of the year. It's the last day of the decade. But it's certainly the last chance you're going to get to make a donation to charity that will reflect on your 2009 taxes. This is a big day in online charitable giving. We're going to talk about that in just later on this hour. And today is New Year's Eve. It's a time when many people not just stock up on champagne and sparklers, but they also make New Year's resolutions. And we're asking people, what is your New Year's resolution? I myself have decided to handle my debt, pay back my student loans. That would be a lovely, lovely thing. And Luke?
I am still going with no fast food in 2010.
So long, Arby's.
Yes, sadly. We've had a good run.
8778-MY-TAKE. Send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, exclusive reporting from the New York Times about the intelligence failures on Christmas Day.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, in for John Hockenberry on this last day of 2009. I'm Luke Burbank. A preliminary report is set to land on President Obama's desk today, attempting to detail how exactly a 23-year-old Nigerian with suspected terrorism ties managed to board a plane with explosives on Christmas Day. That file will also include recommendations on how to prevent future such events. However, Americans could be forgiven for feeling a certain sense of deja vu all over again. Billions of dollars have been spent since 9/11 to improve and try to stop just this kind of thing, improve security, that is, not to mention the myriad rules and regulations that, of course, we all face now when we get on the planes. So did we really learn anything from 9/11? Joining us with the details is Eric Lipton. He's a reporter for The New York Times. Hi, Eric.
Good morning.
Does this breakdown mean that a lot of these post-9/11 measures that were taken were essentially a waste of time?
I don't think it's that harsh. I think that there's been a lot of progress, both in terms of the vetting of people before they get on and before they approach an airport, and then the screening of them once they arrive there. But at the same time, the failure of imagination, the failure to connect the dots, the same phrases that we heard after 9/11, they're coming up again because the system has had a very similar type of failure. And so clearly all the problems have not been fixed.
What exactly did go wrong in this particular case then?
I mean, there's sort of two systems that try to protect aviation. The first has to do with vetting people before they even get to the airport, and the second is the screening them at the checkpoints. And there appear to have been significant failures now in both of those areas. I mean, dating back to August of this year, there were hints that this young man should not have been allowed to board a plane for the United States. And then once he got to the airport in Amsterdam, there should have been a way to detect the explosive that he had on him.
As the days have gone by since Christmas, the White House has sort of gone from saying the system worked to saying mistakes were made to then eventually calling it a systemic failure. Let's hear President Obama on that.
The reviews I've ordered will surely tell us more. But what already is apparent is that there was a mix of human and systemic failures that contributed to this potential catastrophic breach of security.
Eric Lipton from The New York Times, who do you think gets the blame for these failures?
It appears as if the information that came in an intercept that occurred in August of this year, that there was apparently from Yemen, that there was a Nigerian man that was participating in a plot to attack, presumably an American target, was not connected then with the information that later came from the father of this young man, that he had gone to Yemen, and he was a Nigerian, and that he had radical ideas and perhaps in some sense of anti-American feelings. And there was a failure to connect those two critical pieces of information. And the job, the primary agency's job it is to do that would be either the Central Intelligence Agency or what's called the National Counterterrorism Center, which is the place that was created after 9/11 to pull the dots together. Those are the places that are probably under the spotlight the most right now.
Eric, hang on a second. Let's bring in Bob Ayers. He's an international security analyst. He had a 30-year career in the intelligence services, including the CIA and military intelligence, also the National Security Agency. Hi, Bob Ayers.
Hi, good morning.
You've worked across the board in intelligence. What do you think went wrong here? Human error? Is it something more systemic, as the president said?
Well, we're dealing with several problems here. One is that it's very easy to go back in retrospect and identify those bits of information that were actually valid and pointed to something happening. The problem that confronts most intelligence officers or intelligence analysts is not an absence of information, it's too much information. And so if you get 36 messages a day, for example, saying someone from somewhere is going to attack someplace else, which one is real, which one is not real, which one do you act on? It's very difficult to connect the dots, as everyone is saying. You can always connect the dots after the fact, but connecting the dots before the fact is tough. We knew there was going to be a Nigerian, at least rumored to be a Nigerian, perhaps involved in a plot, perhaps traveling to the U.S., perhaps traveling around this time of year. And what are you supposed to do with that? Are you supposed to put out an alert and prevent all not citizens of Nigeria from traveling to the U.S.? Are you supposed to search every one of them, give them a full-body search? How do you deal with it when you get that sort of information? It's not clear, it's ambiguous, and it's not necessarily actionable.
Well, then, I mean, what should you do? I think you make a good point, obviously, that too much information is itself a problem, and yet what's the answer? Because we can't have people on planes with explosives on them.
No, of course you can't. I mean, We have a combination of things that are all at play when it comes to providing for airline security. There are technical attempts to provide for security, you know, screening your baggage, running your bags through an X-ray machine. These are not 100% secure. If you want to screen, for example, passengers, now this sounds a little silly, but to be perfectly safe, you should make everyone strip naked and then fluoroscope the body to make sure they have nothing inside of them. But of course, we can't do that because you have to balance privacy and human rights against the ability of technology to explore what they're carrying and what they have on their body. So we have a technical issue. We also have a privacy issue in that Americans and citizens around the world are very reluctant to have nation states build up massive databases on them that reflect who they are, where they live, what they think, who their friends are, who they talk to on the phone, who they talk to on the internet. People don't like that. And so there's a balance there as well. And then the other contributing factor is one that everyone is pointing to, which is the analytical community dropped the ball this time. They probably missed something that they shouldn't have missed, but that's what human beings do. They make mistakes.
We're talking to Bob Ayers, an international security expert, and also Eric Lipton, reporter for the New York Times. We get a lot of emails and voicemails on this show, and we received one yesterday, an email, where the person basically gave the impression that they just feel almost like everything after 9/11 in terms of the hassle that we've gone through and the money spent was for naught. I mean, can people be forgiven for sort of having that reaction, Bob Ayers? Or is that defeatist, I guess, in some way?
Well, we have to remember that the people that are terrorists, they're not stupid people. The image of an uneducated wild man with an AK-47 is not right. These are intelligent, they're educated, and they're very clever people. And when we develop some countermeasure to a technique, whether it's a shoe bomb or peroxide bombs, they will develop a countermeasure to that. They will come up with a new way to strike. And it goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Now, the fact that we have not had any peroxide bombs or liquid bombs on aircraft, the fact that people have not smuggled in explosives in electronics gear like the Lockerbie flight, all of these point to some degree of success. However, the terrorists keep evolving. They come up with new ways that people hadn't anticipated. So for people that say we haven't learned anything, we've learned a lot because you're not seeing anything that's a repeat of something that had been seen before.
Bob Ayers, international security analyst, thank you very much. And also to Eric Lipton, reporter for the New York Times. At 15 minutes past the hour, let's check the news headlines.
President Obama will be hoping to get some answers today to what went wrong in the lead-up to the failed Christmas Day airliner attack. He'll get a preliminary report from his counterterrorism advisors. Meanwhile, pilots say they should have been warned that there was an attempted terror attack while they were in the air. Mike Karn is from the Coalition of Airline Pilots Association. He says the authorities should have kept pilots around the country. In the know so they could take precautions.
You notify the flight attendants to monitor cabin behavior. Limit the use maybe of lines in front of the laboratory. Monitor the access to the cockpit door.
And finally, earlier on The Takeaway, we heard from Robert Shiller, the inventor of the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. He said there's been an uptick in house prices in many states, but it's unclear how sustainable that is. What is clear, he said, is that fewer people are now able to afford to buy their own homes.
There is a move now toward renting, and that's been going on for a few years now.
Shiller is a professor of economics at Yale University. He spoke with us earlier.
That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, when you look at the sky tonight, there's a really, really cool event going on. Actually, this only happens once about every 20 years. New Year's Eve, we have a blue moon. Not literally blue. It's just that we get more than one full moon in a month. That's what a blue moon is. We're going to be talking about that.
How fitting at the end of the decade.
Right,
a full moon on New Year's Eve,
and that's a blue moon. That's a mixed emotion kind of thing.
Are you going to sing a little blue? Are you going to favor us with some blue moon at some point?
I could break out into song at any moment. It's on the verge.
All right, we're all a Twitter about it.
Hey, you want that to go?
We've got some news takeouts for you right now, stories we've been covering. At least 8 Americans are dead after a suicide bombing at a remote base in Afghanistan. Details are still emerging, but reports are that most of the dead are CIA employees, which could make this one of the most deadly events in the intelligence agency's history. The Taliban has claimed responsibility. Anand Gopal from the Wall Street Journal joins us from Kabul. Anand, new information is emerging this morning about these dead and injured people. What's the latest?
Well, it looks like some of them were definitely CIA officials, but it's not clear if all of them were. And it looks like they were in the gym at a U.S. military compound when the suicide bomber managed to get into the facility and detonate his explosives.
It seems quite surprising that somebody could get onto a secure facility like this with explosive. What do they think this person did to get onto the base?
Well, it's unclear at the moment, but the Taliban said that they had used an Afghan army officer, which, if that's true, then the Afghan army officers are wearing uniforms and may be able to slip by some security that somebody else may not be able to. And that, if it's true, it speaks to a sort of increased sophistication of the tactics of the insurgency.
Can you tell us anything about this place where this happens called Forward Operating Base Chapman? It's in southeastern Afghanistan. It's near Pakistan. It's very remote.
Yeah, it's very remote, and it's in an area that's considered an insurgent hotbed, and a place that sees a lot of attacks in the area daily. So it's something that it's not surprising that insurgents have targeted this, but what's more surprising is that they managed to penetrate the security.
Unfortunately, U.S. military personnel dying in Afghanistan is a somewhat common occurrence, but CIA personnel is much less common. What's the significance of these being CIA?
Well, if they are CIA, it would mark one of the biggest losses of CIA personnel in the history of the organization. And as one CIA official said yesterday, that this would be like the Pearl Harbor of the CIA, if it were true. So it's pretty significant. And psychologically, for the Afghans and for the insurgents to be able to say that they were able to kill 8 CIA officials would be a major propaganda boost for them.
Anand Gopal, Wall Street Journal reporter in Kabul, Afghanistan. Thank you so much for joining us.
And now let's go to Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen for an update on a story we talked about yesterday. A Texas Tech football coach, Mike Leach, was accused of abusing one of his players. And basically what happened is the player complained of having concussions on multiple times. Each time, I guess, Mike Leach did not agree that the player had a concussion, and he put him in what people described as a closet. What's happened now, Ibrahim?
So now the Texas Tech administration has decided to fire Mike Leach. And this is important for a couple of reasons. One is that they're playing in a bowl game in a short time, the Alamo Bowl. And it takes attention away from Michigan State, who actually had 14 players suspended. So if Mike Leach hadn't been fired, we would have been focusing on Michigan State because of that. The other thing is that this is Texas, and Texas Tech specifically, who hired Bobby Knight, who at the time was probably known more for his throwing a chair and abusing basketball players instead of him being the most winningest basketball coach of all time. So it's not like they're an angelic program. The other thing that's interesting here is that this became a national story because the young man at the center of the story, Adam James, is the son of a former NFL player and an ESPN analyst, Craig James. So it kind of blew up a little bit more than you would normally expect it to because of the attention and the spotlight given to him.
But it also addresses the issue that we've been talking about a lot lately, which is concussions as football injuries. And this is a sign of an odd occurrence where a player actually admitted they had a concussion and then wasn't believed.
It's true. And there's another side of this, too. And recently, on November 16th, Kansas investigated Mark Mangino, the head coach, and then they let him go as well. Well, Mark Mangino was accused of also mistreating players. He and Mike Leach also coached underneath Bob Stoops.
Oh, interesting. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor.
I'll tell you, the takeaway for me is that college football loves a winner, and Mike Leach is going to get a job somewhere.
Well, he had the best winning percentage of any Texas Tech football coach, so you're right.
Our final takeaway, when you look up in the sky tonight, you are going to see a beautiful sight. Not just the ball dropping in Times Square. You're going to see a blue moon. Not actually blue. It's a figure of speech, but we've got someone here to help explain it. Jack Horkheimer, writer and host of PBS's Stargazer. He's also director emeritus of the Miami Planetarium. Hi, Jack.
Good morning.
Okay, why do they call it a blue moon? It's not actually blue.
It's just something that's passed into folklore over the past 35 years due to a mistaken incident back in the 40s. It may come from the word betrayal, that this, when you have a two full moons in one month, that the second moon is betraying the calendar, so to speak.
I see.
It really is just a piece of modern folklore.
Now, why is a blue moon significant?
Well, the significance of it tonight is that every 19 years on New Year's Eve, we have a full moon at midnight at its highest point. So tonight, all over the world, if you go outside at the stroke of midnight, your local time, a brilliant full moon will be very high, and in some places, almost overhead. So wherever you happen to be, if you're in Times Square tonight, if it's clear out and you look up overhead at midnight, you'll see a brilliant full moon. If you're in London, Paris, Chicago, Los Angeles, look up at midnight. If it's clear, you'll see a brilliant full moon shining on the new year.
All right, Jack Horkheimer, writer and host of PBS's Stargazer. Nobody can sit on a ring of Saturn rocking a members-only jacket like Jack Horkheimer, that's for sure. Hey, coming up, our week-long exploration of the U.S. Census is going to take us to a prison where we discuss the controversy over whether or not to count prisoners in the states that they're incarcerated in or in the states that they're going to go back to when they leave jail. It's really kind of a tough call. That's coming up in just a few moments on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we're going to continue our week-long look at the upcoming 2010 U.S. Census. And today we're talking about prison inmates because how we count them and where we count them is causing a lot of controversy. That's in just a few minutes. First, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. U.S. military deaths in Afghanistan doubled this year. An AP count shows 304 American service members had died as of December 30th. That's up from 151 in 2008. And that doesn't include civilian deaths. Yesterday, a suicide bomber wearing an Afghan army uniform got into an American base and blew himself up, killing at least eight Americans believed to be working for the CIA. It's one of the deadliest attacks on U.S. intelligence personnel in the agency's history. The Taliban is claiming responsibility. They also say they're behind another attack yesterday, which killed four Canadian troops and 34-year-old Michelle Lan, a reporter for the Calgary Herald newspaper. Her editor paid tribute this morning.
She was the person that you could always look to be an example and to take things and make them special.
It was a dangerous year for journalists worldwide. An international group says 113 were killed this year. That makes that one of the highest numbers on record.
New York City Police Commissioner Ray Kelly says security will be tight for the big New Year's celebration tonight in Times Square.
We will have bomb-sniffing dogs. We have bomb-sniffing technology that we use. We have lots of police officers, lots of detection equipment. Mm. But we live in a dangerous world. There are no guarantees.
Meanwhile, the party has already started in Australia and the South Pacific, where it is now officially 2010. We told you earlier this week about China unveiling the world's fastest train. Well, it got slowed down yesterday by a cigarette. Someone lighting up triggered the alarms, forcing a two-hour stoppage. And speaking of trains, there was a German student thrown off a train because he didn't have a ticket. And then he dropped his pants and tried to moon the security officer. And then his pants got caught on the train door. And then he was nearly killed as he was dragged half naked along the platform out of the station and down onto the tracks. That'll learn you.
That's the hard way to learn.
That's right. Well, some lessons are hard learned. That's one of them, Celeste.
That's one that you don't forget.
That's right. Let's check the markets. Futures are mixed. The Dow gets underway at 10,548. The NASDAQ at 2,291. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
The 2010 census is coming up. It's a once every decade count of everyone who's living in the United States. But how do we count the people who are in prison? It's assumed that we're going to count them, of course. They're living in the United States. But where do we count them? Do we count them where they are in prison, or do we count them in the state where they're going to return once they leave jail? We're joined now by Peter Wagner of the Prison Policy Initiative. It's a nonpartisan organization that documents the impact of incarceration on individuals, communities, and the nation as a whole. Peter, explain this controversy to me. Why do we have this battle over where to count prison inmates?
Because there's so many of them. There's so many people who are incarcerated now that it's actually breaking how our democracy works and how we draw legislative districts.
So what is the argument on both sides?
Well, the argument on the Census Bureau's side is we count people in prison because that's where they physically are on the census and because that's the way that we've counted them since 1790.
And on the other side?
The argument on the other side is that the state constitutions say that incarceration does not change your residence, and the prisoners are not a part of the community where the prison is, so then the 14th Amendment is violated by using prisoners as padding to give extra political representation to districts that are not where the prisoners are from.
Well, let's go to one of those districts that we're talking about here. We're joined by Jim Lehman. He's a county board supervisor in Dodge County, Wisconsin. Jim, nearly half of your district's population are actually prison inmates. Is that correct?
In the city of Waupun?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not quite half. Our population here is 10,718, and out of that, we possibly got around 4,000 inmates.
That's still a sizable portion of your population.
That's correct, and it also, by having that in Waupun, that skews our race. We have, like right here, right now, we have 11.81% in the African American, which is about 1,266 out of the 10,675 out of the 10,718, which normally it would probably be maybe 1.5%. So it skews the whole thing here on the population.
So Peter Wagner of the Prison Policy Initiative, that's a pretty strong argument. Not only is it inflating the size of Jim Lehman's population, but it's also skewing race. It's making it sound as though that particular area is diverse with a lot of minorities, and it's really not.
Absolutely, and that's a real problem because prisoners, of course, can vote, and if they could vote, they'd have to vote back at home. But prisoners are mostly Black or Latino, and they're mostly incarcerated in white legislative districts. So you have this kind of regional and racial bias in how prisoners are counted and then how these legislative districts are drawn. It transfers political power across regions of the state.
And Jim Lehman, these people, as Peter just said, they can't vote. They're in prison. And I'm wondering how that complicates your position as the county supervisor that includes this prison.
Well, I probably have about, I would say, I'm just roughly given a count of about, I have 1,600 people that I'm representing. But then if you figure the inmate population over there, then... I've got 2,000 inmates here, and I've got 1,600 people that's voting for it, well, could vote for me.
Hmm.
So, you know, this is just almost impossible. You know, Wisconsin counts the prisoners here as if they were residents of the communities where they were incarcerated, but they can't vote and remain legal residents of the place where they live in incarceration. So that's the way it is. They you know, they just put it right onto the city or whatever area the prisons are at. And
right.
You just can't vote for them.
Right.
You can't do anything about it.
Yeah, and Peter, we've actually have some arguments from the NAACP, the National Urban League, and some African American leaders like Jesse Jackson. They've said that we need to change this system that we've used since the 1700s. What is their argument?
Their argument is that this is that the Census Bureau has to has made a lot of progress at addressing the differential undercount and addressing some of the systematic biases against how African Americans are counted. And they're looking at this as one of the next issues that the Census Bureau needs to fix.
Because they feel like the place where those African Americans came from is where they need to be counted?
Correct.
Okay. So how do we solve this? I mean, we certainly can't solve it for the 2010 census. It's a little late.
Right, it's absolutely too late to change where prisoners are counted in 2010. But the Census Bureau starts planning the 2020 census right the minute that they finish the 2010 census. So now is the time to start talking about making this the last census to count incarcerated people in the wrong place. We're talking about counting 2 million people in the wrong place here.
2 million.
And then
yeah.
The other solution, though, is that states and counties can just choose to either figure out where the prisoners come from and adjust the data and count prisoners at home for purposes of their state or local redistricting, or counties can just say this is wrong, and 100 counties around the country do this right now. They say the Census Bureau is wrong. prisoners are not residents of this county. We're going to take them out when we draw our districts. Mm-hmm. We're going to draw fair districts based on the number of people who actually live in our county.
That's Peter Wagner, Executive Director of the Prison Policy Initiative. Also, Jim Lehman joined us, County Board Supervisor in Dodge County, Wisconsin. Coming up, it is the last day of the year. It's the last day of the decade, but it's certainly the last chance to give to a charity and have that reflected in your 2009 taxes. We're going to talk about why this is the biggest day for online giving of the year in just a few minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headley.
And I'm Luke Burbank, in for John Hockenberry. They are going to be tearing it up in Russia on New Year's Eve, Celeste, because tomorrow things are going to get a little more expensive in the partying department.
Caviar?
No, in the vodka department. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has put together a new law that starting January 1st is going to raise the minimum price of vodka in Russia. This is an attempt to try to curb the vodka consumption there, because they do have the highest per capita alcohol consumption in the world in Russia. Here to tell us more about this is Boris Maximov. He's a reporter with the BBC Russian service. He joins us from London. Hi, Boris.
Hello, hello, hello.
So what exactly is the plan here?
Well, the plan originally, as originally announced, was to raise taxes on the vodka because the vodka is incredibly cheap in Russia right now. And originally it was announced this year, and it was presented as a budgetary measure, simply just to raise revenue for the state because the Russian economy is suffering like everybody else, is actually probably suffering a little more. And now, you know, when the day is coming, they suddenly remembered about the health of population and are selling it on the terms of health. That the Russians are drinking too much, and if you raise the prices, they'll probably start switching to wine, or as the Russians specialists say, to more savory products like whiskey and grappa, for example.
Because I understand that there's a lot of unregulated, both from a tax standpoint and also from just a what's in it standpoint, vodka that's sold in stores very openly.
Well, officially, the stuff that's sold in stores is not moonshine, though sometimes it does get through. That's why some Scandinavian vodka makers that do sell the stuff in Russia have a special anti-tamper corks, so mm-hmm. you cannot add some moonshine into their bottles and sell it as if it was Absolut or Finlandia or something like that. But I must remind you that the Russian government's for centuries been battling with that problem. Number one, how to raise revenue, and taxes on vodka especially are is a fairly major component of Russian budget. And on the other hand, it was the fact that the population is drinking absolutely incredible amounts of alcohol, mainly vodka, and how to stop it. So now and then they try to curb the enthusiasm of the population for the drink and either ban it or try to restrict it or raise prices on it. They did it in the 19th century. They did it in the beginning of 20th century under the Tsars, and then Bolsheviks, the communists, continued it for a little while. There was a prohibition from 1914 to 1925.
Is this a political suicide for Medvedev? It's a very popular product in Russia.
It is a popular product in Russia. On the political side, probably not, but Russian population is used to it, so people just switch to moonshine or to anything else. When I was a child growing up in Soviet Arctic, the local tipple of choice was eau de cologne and perfume. For example, or people take toothpaste dissolved in water because it does have a minute amount of alcohol. So if you concentrate it nicely, you can get a bit of a buzz. Wow. If you cannot lay hands on that, there is another recipe. You take shoe polish, spread it on the white bread, leave it in the sunshine for a day so it permeates the bread. Then you eat it and you get amazing buzz.
Boris Maximov, reporter for the BBC Russian service. Thank you so much. I guess. People gave us grief for talking about making bombs the other day. That's much more pernicious.
Shoe polish on bread.
Drinking with Boris Maximov. We'll be back in a moment.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with Luke Burbank, who is filling in for John Hockenberry all this week.
Hello, Celeste.
Hello. Coming up, this is the last day of the year, as you know, and many people procrastinate all year long and wait until this very last day to do their charitable giving, and therefore they do it the fastest way possible, which is online through their computer. We're going to talk about what impacts that has in just a few minutes. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Some economic news just in. New jobless claims fell unexpectedly last week to the lowest level since July of 2008. That's the good news. Not such good news from a leading economist who's warning this morning that the recent uptick in house prices in many states may not be sustainable. Robert Shiller of the Case-Shiller House Price Index, speaking to The Takeaway earlier, said an end to federal tax credits and resetting of mortgage interest rates next year may make homes unaffordable for some Americans.
People are heartened by the fact that inventory of unsold homes is apparently declining a bit, but there's this whole shadow inventory threatening to come on the market.
Shiller is a professor of economics at Yale University. He spoke to us earlier. Moving on to the failed terror attack story, officials say President Obama probably won't speak publicly today after he gets a preliminary report on the incident. It's expected to identify some of what went wrong.
In Afghanistan, the Taliban are claiming responsibility for an attack yesterday that killed eight Americans reported to be working for the CIA. The attacker was dressed in an Afghan army uniform. And Afghan police say Taliban militants have beheaded six people they suspected of being spies for the government. In health news, H1N1 flu virus may not be as contagious as experts first thought. Lynn Finelli is the head of flu surveillance at the Center for Disease Control.
The numbers of people getting sick on a daily basis with swine flu is much lower than it was in October and November.
The odds of catching swine flu if a family member has it are about 1 in 8, although children are at a higher risk. That research is in the New England Journal of Medicine. On this date, 2009, I want to remind you of some of the stories that maybe almost didn't make the news this year, but we're going to sneak them in. Russian soccer fans were instructed to drink whiskey on a trip to a soccer game to ward off the virus. Candidates in Japan stopped shaking hands. An inventor in Italy devised an electronic holy water dispenser. If you want to see that kind of stuff, you can probably catch it on a Fox-related channel somewhere, but maybe not tomorrow morning. That's because there is a beef between Time Warner Cable and Fox Networks. We've got more on this from Brian Stelter. He writes the Media Decoder blog for our partner, the New York Times. Hi, Brian.
Good morning.
So what exactly is going on with Time Warner and Fox? They're running all these ads that are saying that Fox, like I'm watching Fox, yeah. And they're saying Fox isn't going to be on. It's confusing.
They're mounting a political campaign, both of these companies are, and it comes down to this. Fox, which is owned by News Corporation, would like a lot more money for the subscribers that cable has, particularly Time Warner Cable. Right now, Time Warner Cable doesn't pay very much to retransmit the Fox signal. Fox wants that to change. They want about $1 per subscriber per month. Of course, the increase would be reflected in your cable bill. Time Warner Cable knows that if Fox gets $1, then CBS and ABC and NBC are going to come knocking as well, and they're trying to hold the line on prices.
So where do things stand right now? Are people going to really turn on their TV tomorrow and not get to see their stuff, or is this just kind of a posturing?
And until the signals go off the air, it's always just a negotiating ploy. Fox did come out last night and say it's looking more and more likely they will have to take the Fox stations off the air in New York, in L.A., in a couple other major markets. Thankfully, it only affects some of News Corp's cable channels. Like, it affects FX for some reason, but not Fox Sports. So there's a bit of confusion, I think, in the marketplace about what will actually go off the air. And, you know, of course, you can always sign up for Dish Network or DirecTV, and of course those satellite companies are already putting ads out there encouraging people to switch just in case Fox does go off the air on Time Warner Cable systems.
Brian Stelter writes the Media Decoder blog for our partner, the New York Times. If you got to have one, keep the Fox Sports tomorrow because that's the football channel with the bowl games. So at least they're prioritizing. You don't buy that. Those are just some of the headlines that we're watching this morning.
It's December 31st, if you hadn't noticed. Tomorrow starts a new year, and this happens to be the biggest day of the year for online giving. Big week for charities. Stacey Palmer is the editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Stacey.
Good morning.
I would assume that the reason this is the biggest day for online giving is because people are trying to get that gift in so it will be reflected in their taxes. Is that right?
That one reason is the tax deduction, but also people are giving much later. They seem to be procrastinating a lot on their giving, and I think that's related to the economy as well.
Okay, it's not just a bleed over from holiday generosity.
It certainly is. The holiday spirit is something that, you know, people are with family. They're thinking about other needy people. And so that is a big reason that people are thinking about their charitable giving. And that tax deadline is also helpful.
You know, it's funny because at the down to the wire, charities who are kind of looking back at 2009 to see whether they had a good or a bad year, there's actually this last minute bump that could turn this from a relatively mediocre year for charitable giving and turn it into a good year, right?
Absolutely. Today is one of those real nail-biter days in a lot of charity offices. They're hoping that people will give very generously because so far it's been pretty sluggish, and many groups are really depending on those last-minute gifts to make their year.
And I'm wondering how much of a bump can it be? Online giving is a little bit counterintuitive. We hear all these stories about how people are shopping more and more and more online, and yet with online giving, they don't. It's a fraction of what they do in terms of real money. In other words, they give about $300 billion every year in the traditional way, with a check or a cash in a Salvation Army red bucket, but only $4 billion online.
The amounts that people give online are growing, but they have been really slow. And sometimes people will look at a charity website and still send in a check. They feel more comfortable doing it that way rather than giving online. So I think as we see shopping taking off more, we'll see charitable giving more. But right now, people aren't entirely comfortable doing it that way, so they give in a lot of other ways. But the internet is still a really important way that they think about where they're going to give.
Okay, well, let's talk to somebody who's making a bet that it is going to grow online, and that's Dejan Vitanev. He's a CEO of the website myphilanthropy.org. Dejan, your site is a kind of hub for online giving?
That's right. At Philanthropedia, we compile expert opinion from foundation professionals, academics, and nonprofit executives in order to highlight and recommend a few nonprofits in different social causes, nonprofits that people can trust and confidently give to.
Now, your site is only 6 weeks old. It sounds to me like you're agreeing with Stacy that online giving is really going to grow in the future. What gives you that idea?
Well, I just think it's a better way to give in many respects. For example, the transaction costs associated with online giving are much lower, and as a result, it really makes sense to gradually convert people to give online. Of course, it takes time, but in many respects, it's simply superior to writing a check. For example, donors can be much better engaged and informed about the progress that an organization is making online.
But Stacy, people still have to make sure that they're reading the fine print and giving to charities where the amount of money that they're giving is going to end up doing some good and is effective.
Absolutely. You want to do your homework before you give. And one of the things that you have to be especially careful is to make sure that you're giving to a legitimate charity and one that's really doing what you want to support.
And one thing that you've pointed out that I wanted to get to before we let you go is texting online. I mean, not online giving, but texting donations, small donations through your phone.
Absolutely. It's a really easy way to give, and it's recently become a lot cheaper, so a lot more of that donation, if you give $5 through a text message, actually goes to the charity. So that's why you're going to get a lot more promotions, and people will be giving that way. So hopefully that will increase giving. It's a small amount for each donor, but that adds up for the charity in a big way.
And the way it works is they use this on This American Life and for public radio as well. They say they give you a code, and you put that code in, and then $5 donation is going to appear in your cell phone bill, right?
Exactly. So it's very simple. That's all you have to do is punch in the code, and then you're done.
Well, that's an easy way to give. I can even do that. Stacy Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, and Dejan Vitanev, CEO of the new site, myphilanthropy.org. This is the biggest online giving day, and if you're going to give, there's no more time left. Time to give today. Thanks to both of you.
And if you've got the phone already at your ear, making your donations, or maybe you're at the computer, take that moment to reach out and touch us here and give us your New Year's resolutions. What are you going to do as we move out of the aughts? You can give us a ring at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can email us mytake@thetakeaway.org. And if you missed anything that happened on today's show or any of the other ones, of course, you can podcast this fine program. You can go to thetakeaway.org and do that, or in iTunes. Here, by the way, is your takeaway.
The failure of imagination, the failure to connect the dots, the same phrases that we heard after 9/11, they're coming up again because the system has had a very similar type of failure. And so clearly all the problems have not been fixed.
That was New York Times reporter Eric Lipton discussing how 9 years after the attacks of September 11th, some systemic difficulties persist in predicting and preventing terrorist attacks.
2010 is going to be my year, man. It's the year I get out of debt and pay off my student loans. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Luke Burbank. It's already been brought in. in 2010. The good luck for Celeste Headlee.
That's right.
And this is The Takeaway.
Rotten?
That's a word.
Most of us think of the house as a home, right? Mom and Dad bought the house. It's where we mark the children's height on the kitchen door frame, light birthday candles, and hang stockings.
Our house in the middle of our street. Our house.
But that's not the picture today in our post-housing crisis world.
The market today is clearly been shifted from the traditional buyer, the husband and wife with the children, looking to buy the home of their dreams. But you see more times than none the investor who's bundling up properties, repairing them, and then putting people in as their tenants.
One man's castle, home is where the heart is. Not anymore. Now we're finding that dream home and renting it on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 31st, New Year's Eve. I'm Celeste Headlee, joined this week by Luke Burbank, who's sitting in for John Hockenberry.
Yes, I am. Happy New Year's Eve morning, Celeste.
Good morning. Yes, thanks.
Hours away from exciting times here in New York. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. U.S. military deaths in Afghanistan doubled this year. An AP count shows 304 American service members had died as of December 30th. That's up from 151 in 2008. That doesn't include civilian deaths. Yesterday, a suicide bomber wearing an Afghan army uniform got into an American base and blew himself up, killing at least eight Americans believed to be working for the CIA. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to the BBC's Peter Grester in Kabul, who told us the target near the Pakistan border is not known to be a traditional military base.
We do understand that they've been CIA operatives have been operating, were working out of that area, keeping track of a lot of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban militants as they cross the border.
It's one of the deadliest attacks on U.S. intelligence personnel in the agency's history. The Taliban is claiming responsibility.
New numbers out last hour. The number of newly laid off workers dropped unexpectedly last week. The Labor Department says new claims for unemployment insurance fell by 22,000. That's down to 432,000 overall, and that's the lowest it's been since July of last year. Now for the latest on the security breakdown that opened the door to that attempted terrorist attack on Christmas Day. President Obama is receiving a report on that security today. And earlier on The Takeaway, Eric Lipton, a reporter for The New York Times, told us much of the failure to connect the dots falls on two agencies.
The primary agency's job it is to do that would be either the Central Intelligence Agency or what's called the National Counterterrorism Center, which is the place that was created after 9/11 to pull the dots together.
Also, the Transportation Security Administration has ordered 150 more full-body scanners to be installed in airports. There's currently 40 in place.
The party's already starting in the South Pacific. It is already 2010 in Australia and New Zealand. Pyrotechnic displays will go up in Hong Kong, even though China uses a different calendar that will mark the end of the new year actually in February.
And we're also taking a look back at the past year in home prices. They're up for the fifth consecutive month, but the housing market hasn't recovered. Martin Torres is with us, and he owns a place right now. But Martin, you're going to become a renter on Tuesday.
That's right.
Why are you becoming a renter?
Well, I saw the prices in the rental market out there, and I just decided the prices were just too good for me not to make the move. So I've been in New York for 20 years now, so I absolutely just had to take it.
So what deal did you get?
Well, it was pretty great, but I had to look. I mean, you know, they're just not laying around. You do have to be persistent. But I found a one bedroom with 1.5 baths. With an alcove that I can turn into a second bedroom, fairly close to Central Park, with a great view, all for less than $900 than I'm paying right now.
Right, but how much is the rent?
The rent is under $3,000. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, someone in Des Moines just fainted there, Martin Torres. Thanks so much, and good luck with the move on Tuesday.
Hopefully, Martin will make some money with the markets. The Dow gets underway today at 10,548. The S&P opens at 1,126. Our takeaway today, at the end of the odds, we're wondering what your New Year's resolutions are. Give us a ring, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email us mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Okay, so clearly one New Yorker, Martin Torres, is extremely happy with the apartment he's getting near Central Park.
Amazing you could be that excited to pay just under $3,000.
But not a lot of happiness elsewhere in the housing market. We often talk on the show about the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. That index, by the way, has told us that in 20 American cities, October was the fifth consecutive month that prices went up. That's pretty good news. There are two people behind this Case-Shiller Index, and we're joined now by one of them, Robert Shiller. He's co-creator of the Home Price Index. And he was one of the few experts that actually warned us of the impending housing crisis. He joins us now to help us look back on what happened to the housing market in 2009. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Celeste.
So as I said, you were one of the few people who said, look, there's a crisis coming and this housing bubble is going to pop. So when do you think that pop occurred, and when did the after effects of the pop begin?
Well, the housing market is very different from the stock market, in that the housing market moves smoothly through time. So we saw a housing boom that began around 1997 and didn't end until around 2006. So it was going up for about 9 years. And then it started going down, and it's been going down with a little interruption recently, about 3 years. So the question is it over? Well, it might be, because it suddenly tipped up. But the downward momentum has been pretty strong, and it leaves you wondering if this was just a temporary upblip.
Well, we spoke with a number of people who work in the housing industry. Let me have you listen to Monique Carter. She works in four different counties in Michigan as a real estate agent, and she says the market for housing has changed.
The market today is clearly been shifted from the traditional buyer, the husband and wife with the children, looking to buy the home of their dreams. But you see more times than none the investor that's flying in from Chicago, flying in from New York, who's bundling up properties and repairing them and then putting people in as their tenants.
So, Robert Shiller, what do you think? Are the average American family not able to afford a house anymore, and so they're renting?
Well, the home ownership rate has declined by, I guess, a couple of percent. So it had been reaching perhaps unsustainable levels under the ownership society of President Bush. I don't mean to blame him for this. It was a boom. People were very excited about owning their own home. And I think she's right that there is a move now toward renting. And that's been going on for a few years now.
Which it sounds like you think is not all a bad thing. But, you know, another big thing that sways the housing market one way and the other is consumer confidence. And we asked a couple agents about what they're seeing in this particular thing. And we got two different stories. Let's listen to this first one. Ed Snively, he's a real estate agent in El Centro, California.
We have seen actually an increase in sales in 2009. Sales are up. And I think that we are seeing confidence coming back, and I think that's terribly important to our economy. People have to feel this thing is working.
Okay, so Robert Shiller, that's Ed Snively in El Centro, California, saying that consumer confidence coming back up. But here's a clip from Baru Shahidi. He's a real estate agent in North Jersey.
This year has been the most challenging year of my life. Largest contributor to this has been the psychology of the market, because even if you provide the absolute best by listening to your client very attentively, at the moment of decision-making, they would stop and say, am I getting the best deal? Do you think if I just go for one more month, the prices would go further down? So maybe I should pause.
So are these things both going on nationally, or is the housing completely individual to the community where they are?
Well, it's all the time true that both are going on. That's the way markets work. There are people who are getting confident and getting excited, and there are other people who are thinking, maybe I better wait a few months. And the price is a outcome of like a tug of war between the two groups. And which group is a little bit more numerous than the other, and it's hard for anyone to see. It's partly regional, and Ed Snively, I know, was from California. And, you know, I had the same feeling there, that I was meeting a lot of people who were thinking this is a buying opportunity. California is a volatile state, and they've had a history of ups and downs, and so people out there are very alert to any changes in the signals.
You know, there's a couple things coming up next year, Robert Shiller, that I wanted to check in with you on. One is that some of these federal tax credits for first-time home buyers are going to expire for the last time. The other is that everyone keeps talking about the resetting of interest rates and that may bring on a wave of foreclosures. So when we factor both of those things into the equation, does that give us a better idea on whether the housing crisis is over?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because the federal government has been more supportive of the housing market than ever before. This is astonishing how much support the government is giving. In fact, the government is really financing practically all of our new mortgages through their support of Fannie and Freddie. And we just heard on New Year's Eve that the Obama administration has no limits on how much. It used to be a $400 billion limit, but now they've crossed that out on how much they'll support Fannie and Freddie. So the government and the tax credits are just unprecedented. So the government is effectively allowing people to borrow with zero money down, if you count the $8,000 tax credit. So there's a massive support, and the big question that everyone is asking is what will happen when that support is withdrawn?
And that's what I'm asking.
Well, I think that the reason the market tipped up so sharply since March or April of this year has to do with those policies. People see that, and they think this is a short term good news, and everyone's wondering what it means for the longer term.
Which is what I'm wondering, and it sounds to me, Robert Shiller, like you don't want to commit. The last question is of course, this interest rate reset. I think a lot of people assumed that before we got to this point that banks would have renegotiated mortgages with people to make sure that everyone could afford their mortgage. That hasn't happened. So is this an oncoming new wave of foreclosures?
Absolutely. That's the worry. It's called the shadow inventory. People who are still in their homes, but those homes are going to be on the market before long. People are heartened by the fact that inventory of unsold homes is apparently declining a bit, but there's this whole shadow inventory threatening to come on the market.
Robert Shiller, thanks so much. Professor of Economics at Yale University, also co-creator of the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's take a look now at the news headlines.
We were just hearing about the housing market, where the news is kind of mixed. But on the job market, actually, there are some figures that give reason for optimism. The number of newly laid off workers filing claims for unemployment benefits dropped last week to the lowest figure since July of last year. President Obama will hope to get answers about the failed Christmas Day airliner attack today. The president is due a report on the attempted bombing from his counterterrorism advisors. Earlier on The Takeaway, former CIA employee Bob Ayers defended the intelligence agencies, saying similar types of attacks are not being repeated.
So for people that say we haven't learned anything, we've learned a lot, because you're not seeing anything that's a repeat of something that had been seen before.
Meanwhile, a pilots group says flight crews should have known about last week's attempted terror attack while it was happening. Mike Karn is the security chair of the Coalition of Pilots Association.
Clearly, you've got a situation here where information was not arriving in a timely manner to airborne crews to protect those crews and those passengers. Thousands of people were left in the dark.
He says the Transportation Security Administration should have done more.
In Afghanistan, the Taliban is claiming responsibility for two major attacks yesterday. Eight Americans thought to be working for the CIA were killed in a suicide bombing at a base near the Pakistan border. And elsewhere, four Canadian soldiers and a journalist were killed in a roadside bombing. In neighboring Pakistan, the United Nations says its plans to temporarily relocate some of its international staff outside of the country for security reasons. In Hawaii, Rush Limbaugh says he's resting comfortably after he suffered chest pains yesterday and was rushed to the hospital there in Honolulu. And in Australia, Sydney has ushered in the new decade with a huge fireworks display over the city's landmark Harbour Bridge and Opera House. At least a million and a half people were said to have witnessed it. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we will get a check on reporters from around the world, including somebody in Sydney, on the upcoming and past celebrations for New Year's.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now time for some New Year's takeout, and I'm not talking about Chinese food delivered to your door. We're talking about scenes from around the world as New Year's approaches. And in one particular place of the world, well, a few places, but one special place, New Year's has come and gone. We're going to speak now with Phil Mercer. He's a BBC correspondent in Sydney. Phil, you've been in the New Year for 20 minutes now. Phil, in Sydney is too excited over the coming of the new year. Yeah, he is. He's really
the
overwhelmed.
Intense fireworks.
So instead, let's go to someone who's a little calmer. Lori Raimondo, she's with the Times Square Alliance in New York City. She's in charge of, actually, one of the people's in charge of putting together the ceremony in New York. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning.
Well, the weather is not conducive for outdoor celebrations right now.
Yeah, you know, but we are, you know, first, I'm looking out my window at Times Square, and it's actually beautiful on any other day, but we are always prepared well ahead of time for this event to happen regardless of any type of weather. So yeah, we plan for this.
You're also prepared for extra security tonight, correct?
Yeah, you know, I've been listening a lot where they're talking about all the security, and the event always has an amazing amount of security, and I think because of Reese's incidents, they're highlighting more of the things they do, but it's always an extremely secure place.
And one other thing that's been pointed out is people need to remember, if they're among the million people going to Times Square, that there aren't really any public bathrooms.
That is correct. There's not one set up specifically for this event.
The snow
but, you
does
know,
not
people,
count.
Yeah, people, you know, people, you know, there's businesses that are open around here. People, it's always nice, and especially in Times Square on New Year's Eve, to be nice and polite with everybody around you and the businesses, and people are usually gracious. Yes.
Politeness, something that New York City is known for.
Yay!
Lori Raimondo at the Times Square Alliance, thanks so much. Let's go to Sydney now. Phil Mercer, BBC correspondent there. Phil, you are 20 minutes into 2010. What's it like?
We're a bit further than that, actually. We're more than an hour into
right.
the new decade. And, the Australian public here in Sydney and the huge numbers of international visitors who invariably come to this part of the world for this particular evening would have thoroughly enjoyed themselves. They've seen 5,000 kilograms of explosive devices detonated in the night sky. 25,000 shooting comets have been launched up into the air, and Sydney Harbour is beautiful by day, and by night time tonight it looked absolutely stunning. So the people who came today certainly weren't disappointed, and of course this is an event that's broadcast live on national TV too, so this is an event that many Australians will be very proud of, I think.
Well, what do you think? They were estimated that there was going to be well over a million people, perhaps a million and a half. Do you think that you reached that number?
Somewhere in between that figure. Invariably, people do flock to Sydney for these very special events. There's a family fireworks at 9 o'clock in the evening, and the main event 3 hours later at midnight, of course. And traffic has been streaming into the city all day. Trains have been full, and people arriving by air too, just to witness those 12 minutes of pyrotechnic wonder at midnight. So it's cost an awful lot of money. More than $4.5 million US dollars has been ploughed into this event, but the local economy hopes to make much more than that. So this is all about entertainment and money, and I imagine that the organisers would be extremely pleased. They did boast that this New Year's Eve fireworks display would be the largest and most technologically advanced anywhere in the world. I think that boast has been
realised. Did it live up to the hype, Phil? Was it worth $4.5 million?
Well, I'd rather they would have given it to me, but I don't imagine that was on
that
the
cards. That would have made it a great new year, wouldn't it, Phil Mercer?
Everyone come round to my house.
BBC correspondent in Sydney. Let's go now to Munich. Tristana Moore, BBC correspondent there. Good morning, Tristana. Good afternoon,
Hi.
I should say.
Good afternoon.
You aren't quite ready to start your New Year's celebrations there. What time is it in Munich?
It's 3:25 at the moment, but people are really gearing up for New Year's Eve tonight in Munich. And there's going to be a huge party right by the old city hall at Marienquai. And a lot of people will be gathering on the bridges over the River Isar to see the big fireworks display. And, you know, people in Munich, they love to dance, party and feast. And there's going to be a lot of food and a lot of beer that's going to be drunk tonight.
You know, here's an odd coincidence. Also in the United States, we like to dance, party and drink. And feast.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I don't know. I always think that people think Germans are very serious, but actually, you know, they love New Year's Eve.
Oktoberfestland.
Absolutely. And lots of tourists coming here as well. I mean, just look at the numbers they're expecting in Berlin this year. They're saying up to 1 million people are going to attend the fireworks display at the Brandenburg Gate. And they've opened up this massive New Year's Eve party mile, which extends to about 2 or 3 kilometres behind the Brandenburg Gate, right up to Victory Column, and there's going to be a fireworks display there at midnight, and before that, lots of pop groups and lots of eating and drinking that's going to be going on.
I would imagine something that's kind of uniting the world right now is that universally people seem to be ready to let this decade and this year go. Is that just your feeling in Munich?
Absolutely. And here in Germany, they've really had a difficult year. And I think a lot of people here are going to be very pleased to see the back of this year. After all, Germany suffered its worst recession since the end of the Second World War. And in fact, Chancellor Merkel has just been giving a speech on national TV, and she warned of more tough times ahead. But I think, you know, most people will be looking forward to the new year and hoping that they're going to put this recession behind them and that the economy will start picking up again.
It can only get better from here, right, Tristana?
Absolutely.
Tristana Moore, BBC correspondent in Munich, where they're going to be celebrating the new year in a few hours. It's already 3 p.m. in Munich, and clearly it's 9:30 on the Eastern Seaboard, and people in California are perhaps just waking up. But all across the world, New Year's is coming.
Yes. I'm just waking up, which is problematic because...
That is a problem since you've been on the air for a couple hours.
But I'm definitely starting to hit my stride.
We're going to be asking you all day about your New Year's resolutions. The way to tell us what they are is at 8778-MYTAKE, or you can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Happy New Year's Eve, everybody.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Luke Burbank in for John Hockenberry. According to U.S. officials, 8 American civilians were killed in Afghanistan Wednesday by a suicide bomber. Former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan, Marvin Weinbaum, drops by the studios with the newest developments via telephone. That is right now, though. Let's check in on the top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Also in Afghanistan, another attack killed 4 Canadian troops and 34-year-old Michelle Lan, a reporter for the Calgary Herald newspaper. Her editor paid tribute to her this morning.
She was the person that you could always look to be an example and to take things and make them special.
It was a dangerous year for journalists and international groups as 113 were killed this year, one of the highest on record. This morning, the United Nations says it is temporarily moving some international staff out of Pakistan for security reasons. And chest pains have landed Rush Limbaugh in a Hawaiian hospital. The conservative radio host says he's resting comfortably, appreciates his fans' prayers and well wishes.
Party's underway in Sydney.
4, 3, 2, 1. Happy New Year!
It is already 2010 in Australia and the Far East. Big firework displays in Hong Kong, and even though China uses a different calendar, it also it'll mark the new year in February. They're still having celebrations there, though. Here at home, New York City Police Commissioner Ray Kelly says security will be tight for the big New Year celebration in Times Square.
We will have bomb-sniffing dogs. We have bomb-sniffing technology that we use. We have lots of police officers, lots of detection equipment. Mm. But we live in a dangerous world. There are no guarantees.
And on this last day of 2009, we want to remind you of some of the perhaps offbeat stories of the year. For example, in Venezuela, President Hugo Chavez decided they could save water and electricity by getting people to stop singing in the shower. Also, social media, big thing in 2009, but perhaps Maryland's Dana Hanna took it too far when he was Twittering the entire way down the aisle and through his own wedding ceremony. Taking a check at the markets. After Asian markets finished up for 70% of the year, the Wall Street is going to end the year today as well. The Dow keeps bouncing back and forth. Right now it's up about 5. The S&P is up about 1 and the NASDAQ about 2. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
At least 8 Americans are dead after a suicide bombing at a remote base in Afghanistan. Details are still sketchy, but indications are that most of the dead are CIA employees, which could make this one of the most deadly events in the intelligence agency's history. The Taliban has claimed responsibility. We were joined earlier by Marvin Weinbaum, a former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan. He is currently a scholar with the Middle East Institute. And also we were joined by Peter Gresta, BBC Afghanistan correspondent in Kabul. We asked Peter to tell us more about the base where this attack happened. It's called Forward Operating Base Chapman, and it's near the Pakistan border.
It's in an area, in a province called Khost. We don't know a great deal about exactly what goes on in that base. It is, as you say, very remote and isolated, but we understand it's quote, not regular, which implies that it is, in fact, a base for CIA operations. Now, we do understand that they've been CIA operatives have been operating, were working out of that area, keeping track of a lot of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban militants as they cross the border. That area is known for a lot of the routes over the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Peter Gresta from the BBC. In Kabul, there are rumors, I guess you could say, circulating that maybe this was an inside job, because it just seems so audacious that someone could walk onto a secure facility. What are you hearing about that?
We've got no confirmation from American authorities, but we have been talking to a Taliban spokesman who said that, yes, indeed, it was one of their operatives who got onto the base by infiltrating the Afghan National Army. And we understand he was dressed, or at least it was claimed that he was dressed as an Afghan Army officer, and made it onto the base through the security checks with a suicide vest. Now, obviously, there will be a lot of questions about how he managed to do that, if indeed it is confirmed. But either way, the fact that there was a breach, I think, is going to also raise a lot of questions about the coalition forces' ability to protect themselves from infiltrators like this.
Marvin Weinbaum with the Middle East Institute. What is the significance of these victims being CIA and not otherwise military?
Well, clearly, we have to ask whether they were being specifically targeted, and one would think so here, that the people who perpetrated this knew what they were doing. There's perhaps some reason to believe that the operatives here on the Taliban side were coming from North Waziristan, which implicates a group called the Haqqani Group, and who are closely allied with the Taliban and with al-Qaeda.
Marvin, can I just ask, what exactly is the CIA doing right now in that part of Afghanistan?
Well, it's involved in a variety of activities. Obviously, it's recruiting people, because so much of what they need is gathered from human intelligence, which requires that they make contacts across that area. There's also perhaps those who are there for targeting purposes. You are, of course, reasonably close to the border with Pakistan. There are analysts as well. So there are a variety of people, some of whom may even be contracted people, not all of them necessarily direct hires from the CIA.
Is it possible, because of the CIA's nature, Marvin, that we will actually never know the names of these dead?
I believe eventually we will. The CIA does indicate those who have died in similar circumstances. So I believe that eventually most of them will be known. But perhaps you're correct. There may be some that may not be revealed.
Peter Gresta, BBC correspondent in Afghanistan. You heard Marvin Weinbaum saying that there's been whispers, I guess, that this could have been efforts of the Haqqani group. And we've also gotten reports lately that that's the one particular group that's tied to terrorism that the Pakistani government is kind of hands off with. So this would be a particularly difficult place for retaliation.
Look, yeah, I think we need to be very careful about jumping to conclusions about who was responsible here. If it was in fact an Afghan National Army officer, for example, we know that there's a deliberate policy of moving people around, that they deploy Afghan soldiers in areas that they do not come from. So there is a fair chance that if it was an Afghan Army officer, someone who was infiltrated in there, that he was from another district. We just don't know. But either way, you're right. This is a very, very difficult area for the coalition forces to operate. It is extremely difficult even for the Pakistanis to work in. Whether that's a deliberate decision or a fact of the operating environment is also very difficult to say. But I think we're going to see some very difficult questions asked now about how you protect yourself from infiltrators, particularly when the policy is to work very closely indeed with Afghan security forces. And remember, one of the policies of President Obama is to encourage or build up Afghan security forces quite dramatically so that they can take over the fight. And of course that means dramatically increasing the numbers. There's a great deal of pressure on the Afghan security forces at the moment to try and build up their numbers, and inevitably that means that there may be lapses in the screening procedures.
That was Peter Gresta, BBC correspondent in Afghanistan, who joined us earlier from Kabul, and Marvin Weinbaum, former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan with the Middle East Institute. Hey, coming up, our political decade began with a contested election. It ended with a new leader promising all kinds of change, and in between, things got a little weird. We're going to take a look back at the last decade in American politics with Richard Wolff. That's coming up. Also, we're taking your New Year's resolutions. What are you going to try to do or not do in the coming year? Give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE. You can email us to mytake@thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm Luke Burbank in for John Hockenberry. He will be back on Monday. But Celeste Headlee is here, too.
That's right. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's the end of the year. Time to make we at the end of every year, but especially at the end of the decade, you got all the best of and worst of lists. So we have another one that's a little bit off the beaten track. This is the best of and the worst of catchphrases, brought to us by Ron Rosenbaum. He's a columnist for Slate, and he's been compiling this list of notable catchphrases of the past 10 years and writes about it in Slate this week. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Celeste.
So let's get right to it. Before we get to what you call the best catchphrase of the decade, or the top catchphrase, let's talk about some of the runners-up. What were some of the good ones?
Well, I have to say, the public option is one of the most misleading and sadly opaque catchphrases, because if the people who, as I am, in favor of a public option, had come up with something that people could rally around rather than people could say, I think the whole history of healthcare reform would be changed.
You mean if it was as catchy as death panel, for example?
Exactly. Of course, there's this awful phrase, an Anglophile phrase, at the end of the day, which everyone uses, and it makes them sound profound, supposedly. There are a couple ones I like, game changer and workaround, but I think we could do with enough, no more outside the box, for instance.
That's been around for a while, though, Ron Rosenbaum. So let's see, what was your pick? You mentioned the catchphrase of the decade. What is it?
Well, you know, I chose, and I'm not saying that it's my favorite phrase, but I chose the takeaway,
I applaud that decision.
And when I originally wrote about catchphrases about a year and a half ago, it was when your show was started, and I actually sort of had some criticism of it because I thought it sounded too Dilbert-like, too reductive, too sort of management speak.
But who turned out to be right?
I can't argue with success.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the end of the day, it turned out to be a sort of outside-the-box title for a show.
You know, here's the thing, Ron. The one thing that's interesting about your article is that although catchphrases, it seems like kind of a lighter topic, you argue that actually catchphrases really speak to kind of some underlying things going on in society.
Well, you know, for instance, there's this long-lasting catchphrase, the banality of evil, which I wrote about recently in Slate, and I think it's really misleading, and it makes people sound like they understand the mystery of evil, and in fact, I think it's a really superficial way of looking at evil. And a lot of catchphrases contain a kind of hidden agenda that, workaround, for instance, which I kind of like, is a sort of ethical-sounding way of doing something sketchy or dodgy, I think.
Yeah, and obviously catchphrases like death panel, public option, can be used to manipulate public opinion. Ron Rosenbaum, columnist for Slate. He's also author of Shakespeare Wars. Join us. Catchphrase of the decade, the takeaway here.
Yes. I knew there was something right about this show.
Right.
The title. This is The Takeaway. I'm Luke Burbank in for John Hockenberry. Also here is Celeste Headlee.
I am here.
Coming up, we'll take a look back at the political decade that was as part of our series looking back on the double aughts, the noughts, whatever it is
whatever
we're
calling
the thing we're leaving in a matter of hours here. Right now, though, we're going to check the leading news stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Officials say President Obama probably won't speak publicly today after he gets a preliminary report on the failed Christmas airliner attack. The report is expected to contain recommendations on how to prevent a similar incident.
Meanwhile, details continue to emerge about the past of Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab. That's the Nigerian man who attempted to blow up a Detroit-bound aircraft. We spoke earlier with Mark Doyle, a BBC correspondent in Nigeria. And I asked Mark whether or not the Nigerian government has been saying about the story, given that the suspect is Nigerian.
The Nigerian government, after a couple of days of the shock settling in here, that this Nigerian passport holder who'd actually been living abroad for a while had come back briefly to Nigeria and got on the plane. After a couple of days of hiatus, they are explaining their position, and it's basically that they want to increase security at the airports. They've said that they're going to get hold of some of these full-body scanners for some of the airports. They're not here yet, but that's their intention. They want to make sure that this doesn't happen again. They insist that Nigeria is not a country that meddles in what they call terrorism.
And his family, have they changed what they have to say?
His family put out an official statement, a written statement, as it were, in which they expressed regret. And they also explained that they had spoken to U.S. embassy here in Nigeria and to one of the Nigerian intelligence agencies, expressing their concerns about the behavior of their son. And I believe that those concerns were particularly expressed when their son sent them a text message saying that he was going to be in Yemen, which is a country which is known to have an al-Qaeda presence, and he didn't want to he wanted to cut off his links with his home community and his home family. And that's what prompted the family to go to the U.S. embassy and to talk to one of the Nigerian intelligence agencies.
Well, what do the people in the country think, and his community and his neighborhood?
Well, people in the country, I think, what do they think about the actions of the family? Many Nigerians believe that the father was very brave and courageous to despite the bonds that of course he had with his son. Was very courageous to share what is really personal information with government agencies, American and Nigerian government agencies, to try and resolve the situation. So he's seen by some Nigerians as something of a hero, having done that. What do Nigerians think about the reaction of their government? Well, they're skeptical about everything that their government does. They always have been, and they always will be.
Wells, the international development correspondent for our partner, the BBC. He spoke to us from Nigeria. New jobless claims are out. The number of newly laid off workers filing claims for unemployment benefits fell unexpectedly last week to the lowest level since July of 2008. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Of course, this week we're looking back on the major issues from the past decade. You can't do that without talking politics.
The race for president comes down to Florida.
And now, my friends, it's time for me to go.
Whether you voted for me or not, I will work to earn your respect. The resolve of our great nation is being tested. But make no mistake, we will show the world that we will pass this test.
Bush administration officials are pressing for swift action to show resolve against Saddam Hussein.
Democrats benefited from a 1-2 punch of voters unhappy with the war in Iraq.
Yes, we can!
The poll finds Americans disapproved of President Obama's handling of the economy, and more people have lost confidence in Obama on Iraq and Afghanistan over the last month.
All right, every decade probably has its moments that feel important, but for reals, the 2000s had some incredibly important moments, and here to help us pick through those is Richard Wolff, MSNBC political analyst. He's also the author of Renegade, The Making of a President. Richard, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start at the very early stages of the 2000s, in 2000 itself, the disputed election of George W. Bush. Where does that? How does that kick things off for us?
Badly. The intense partisanship we saw in the 90s, especially obviously around the impeachment of Bill Clinton, could have abated, but in fact they intensified. And it's easy to overlook 2000, although at the time it was a very obsessive moment in the national and international politics, but everything that happened afterwards kind of makes it easy to think about the pre-9/11 phase and then dismiss all of that. But the lingering bad effects of of the questions of legitimacy around President Bush, how he governed after that, really come back to Florida. And while they were sort of papered over in the post 9/11 feeling, I think they came back with a vengeance as the Bush presidency continued. So that intense partisanship, that idea that you don't just oppose a president, you actually have to destroy him, I think starts with impeachment. But 2000 and the muddy aftermath of that contested election really takes you through to the current period, where we see Republicans trying to do the same thing to President Obama, not just oppose, but destroy and decimate the presidency.
So you feel it kind of opened up a new kind of viciousness in terms of trying to take down a president.
It did, and sustained it in a way that it should have ended with the new decade of 2000 and the new presidency.
Let's move to September 11th, which we would, I guess, clearly have to say is the defining political moment of this decade that we're at the end of.
Yeah, and I'm looking at this from a political prism here, and not the human tragedy and the war that followed, but really what we saw after 9/11 was the creation of two really strong political forces that were relatively new to the debate. One was the politics of fear, and fear of attack, and national security in general, but fear itself is a powerful motivator of voters. And secondly, this question of patriotism, of the flag, wrapping yourself in the flag, those two forces were extremely powerful in two election cycles, 2002, 2004. Republicans tried to use them again in 2006 and 2008 with far less effect. So 9/11 really injected those two things. They're always there in any nation's politics, but they really raised them to the fore, and they proved incredibly effective and powerful.
Are moving from destruction of a man-made variety to a natural disaster, although you could argue that man helped lay the groundwork for it to a degree, Hurricane Katrina, which comes along.
Yeah, you know, Hurricane Katrina I see as a sort of a bookend to what happened the year before, which was the civil war in Iraq. It really kind of undermines this idea of strength of the federal government being something that people could rely on in times of trouble. And it really weakens the notion of President Bush as a strong leader, and that the federal government could be there and save us all. So that really leads you into 2006 and 2008. People have called it, I guess, every pun intended, a watershed moment, but that's really what it represents, that rebalancing of confidence about what government can do and what President Bush can do, and this idea that strong leaders can save us all.
Do you feel like that level of dissatisfaction that a lot of Americans felt in this incredibly intense way after Katrina in some way kind of launched Barack Obama into where he ended up?
There would be no Barack Obama, certainly not as president, were it not for the failures of the second Bush term. There is no question about that. And actually, Katrina gave him his first national moment in terms of appearing on the national stage. So there is a link there between what we saw in the civil war in Iraq, the Hurricane Katrina, the sort of collapse of faith in government and in President Bush, and the rise of Obama, which really it comes down to Iowa in 2007. Not when he won, but this long quiet period when he was building up his campaign, his voice, his persona, out of much of the public eye in 2007.
Starting with the Bush administration, but then really revving up when President Obama took office, is this financial meltdown and trying to sort of fix it. That's obviously another big moment.
Yeah, you know, normally in American politics, we find that public opinion trusts business over government. What the recession and meltdown did was to weaken, really undermine to a huge degree, people's idea that business would be there if government wasn't. It's kind of recalibrated for a brief moment the idea that government can help us, but only for a brief moment. And the force, the desire for change, the public anger is really something that wasn't abated with the election of Barack Obama. It's continued now. It threatens to envelop him too.
Well, Richard Wolff, we'll meet you back here in 10 years and, I don't know, 8 hours or whatever it is to talk about the next decade. Richard Wolff, MSNBC political analyst and author of Renegade.
We've been asking people, all day long, what resolutions you have planned. This is one of my favorites.
I resolved to watch more I Love Lucy reruns and also to drink more beer and to be more fluent in multilingual profanity.
That's what you do. You make attainable New Year's
resolutions.
Mine
I bet
is to
he
eat more pizza.
Follow
the
through
show.
On all of those. 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can always get our podcast if you've missed anything at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Luke Burbank. This is The Takeaway. Have a great New Year's.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.